Hey guys, are you ready for some money rehab?
Wall Street has been completely upended by an unlikely player, GameStop.
And should I have a 401k?
No,
I know.
Girl. You think the whole world revolves around you and your money? Well, it doesn't.
Charge for wasting our time. I will take a check.
Like a old school check.
You recognize her from anchoring on CNN, CNBC, and Bloomberg. The only financial expert you don't need a dictionary to understand. Nicole Lapin.
When we think of industries that are contributing to the climate crisis, we're of course thinking of the energy industry or manufacturing. But what about the fashion industry? The fashion industry, especially fast fashion, is a significant contributor to climate change. That's why on the show, I have been a huge advocate for selling the clothes in the back of your closet and also buying secondhand. It's good for your wallet and the environment. Win-win. So today I'm sitting down with Rati Sahi Levick, president of The RealReal, the luxury goods resale brand. We're going to talk about the business of fashion, how clothing can be an investment, and whether the brand itself is on the path to profitability. Because as you business nerds know, The RealReal recently came out with earnings that got some analysts and investors out there cranky. But more on that with Rati. Rati, I'm so excited to say welcome to Money Rehab.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk to you.
I am a long-time customer and seller of The RealReal. I actually just opened my app, and since 2017, I've sold $90,000.
Awesome!
Which is bananas. It's actually gone up since I first wrote these notes. $90,250.
That is awesome.
And VIP status. So I'm a big fan, and we can start there. I have always been rooting for the company for many macro and personal microeconomic reasons. I'm an early adopter, and I knew some of the early employees of the company. But for those who don't know, I'd love to start out by hearing the origin story of The RealReal. Can you share that story?
Yes, I can. I'll say that, you know, 11 years ago now, we started the company with Julie Wainwright, who is the original founder. And, you know, at the beginning, it was a nascent industry, I'd say. Not a lot of people. We were introducing a lot of people to consignment and resale. And I think it still had this certain stigma to it. So not everyone wanted to buy used clothes or talk about it, or, you know, it became, we even saw it in the comments on our, and, you know, our net promoter score, like, I'm going to give you a one because I don't want anyone knowing that I buy resale, or I don't want anyone knowing about resale in general. And you know, they don't want anyone taking their size. There's only so many size sevens in their Chanel shoe or whatever it was. There were a lot of reasons why people kept it a secret. And you know, it was, we always said we wanted to take the top off the eBay and the bottom off of Sotheby's and Christie's and really sit in that kind of middle ground and diversify, right? When there's not a lot of places that where you can sell ready to wear and shoes and fine jewelry and watches. So, you know, we find our job is to educate our sellers every day and how they could retain resale value and what could that could look like, and to be a part of the circular economy. And a lot of the reasons I was so excited was just the sustainability factor, you know. And back in the day, you know, even 10 years ago, it was the stat was 2,000 items were being thrown away every second. And people thought clothing was disposable and you could literally take a top and throw it in the trash. And that continues to happen. That stat is still very similar. And our job is to educate people into what holds its resale value, what, you know, what retains its value, why items shouldn't be thrown away if you're buying well in the primary market. And I'd say one other thing that, you know, people always ask me, like, when did you know this was really going to take off? Or, you know, because in the early days we were working out of Julie's house, and then we moved into like, it was a true startup story, right? And we were unpacking boxes, pickpacking and shipping, answering
like a U-Haul or something.
It was like my beat up Toyota RAV4. Yeah, it was, we didn't even have a U-Haul, and just driving around, you know, trying to find sellers, literally cold calling and trying to find stylists that wanted to consign with us. And I knew it was going to really take off when sellers started to call us and say, hey, I'm at Barney's, back when Barney's was around, or Neiman Marcus, and I am deciding between two bags. What holds its resale value? Like, or I'm deciding between, you know, a Louis Vuitton and a Givenchy, like, what should I buy? What holds its resale value? And they were really starting to make decisions in the primary market based on the resale value. And say that, I knew it was going to be successful based on that story. And then when people just started sending us Birkins in the mail, just shipping Birkins, no one even had to pick up. And I was like, wow, the trust is pretty amazing. So it's been really fun. It's been a fun ride.
It sounds like one. I think of those types of purchases, Louis Vuitton or Givenchy, or, you know, the Chanels or the Birkins that hold their value, or in some cases appreciate, almost like a bond. If you're going to buy it, you kind of know that you're going to get the equivalent or sometimes more in the resale market. And that's a big deal for the fashion industry. But I'd love to click on the circular economy for a moment. The environmental impact of the fashion industry is significant. And if changes are made to the industry, it could really impact fighting climate change. Can you tell listeners a little bit more about the environmental impact of the fashion industry and fast fashion?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so much water, so much carbon. I mean, it's a wasteful industry. There's a McKinsey study that recently was published around revealing that if one in five garments by 2030 is recycled or recirculated, it's key to achieving the 1.5 degree climate goals. And so that alone, you know, is huge. And, you know, how do we get people to really understand that? And understand the pollution around the fashion industry. Do we try not to be so insular, because resale on a whole is good for the planet. It's not just about the real. And how do we get more and more people partaking in this? And I think, you know, it's important to call out the fast fashion brands or some of these mall brands that aren't thinking about fashion this way and are thinking about it as being disposable and more is more. And we're seeing a shift in our consumer behavior where they're buying, you know, maybe they're not buying, you know, 50 items in a year, especially with the younger demographic. They're buying maybe 10 items a year, 15 items a year, but they're buying well, and then they're reselling it and earning some of it back. So seeing that kind of change is really interesting. We launched a sustainability calculator in 2018, which I'm sure you've seen on the site if you're on our site, and it just shows the impact that one person has on recirculating their goods or buying with the real. So how much water and carbon is being saved?
Can I tell you mine?
Yeah. Yes, please tell me.
Well, sister, I have saved 60,890 liters of water.
That's awesome.
Woohoo! I have saved 1,244 kilograms of carbon.
That's awesome.
Go me.
Well, it's a feel good moment too, right? And it makes you realize that you can have an impact.
Yeah. And it sounds like less is more, and buying more expensive could actually in the long run be better for your wallet. And I know you probably don't want to call out specific fast fashion brands unless you do, by all means, but I would love to. Yeah, the Forever 21s of the world. I mean, it's like disposable clothing, and ultimately you're not going to get that value back. And especially with the carbon footprint, can you explain how shopping secondhand affects customers' own environmental footprint? I see mine calculated because I'm a customer and a seller, but how can people start thinking about that as they're shopping?
Right. Well, yeah, there's the environmental impact, but like you said, there's also the piece that's good for the pocketbook too, right? And I think we don't talk about that enough as well. You know, you go into a mall and you buy a $200 cashmere sweater, and you can buy a $200 Prada dress on the site. That's our average selling price, about $200. And you can earn 50, 60% of it back instead of, you know, donating it. So like you said, there is this piece that's good for the wallet as well. But as far as your personal impact on sustainability and the water and carbon savings. As a whole, we've saved 3.1 billion liters of water. So that's like equivalent to 13 billion glasses of water and 59,000 metric tons of carbon. And so that amount, that's like 9.9 million trees to absorb in a year. So again, these numbers start to add up, and I think the sustainability calculator was really, it took us years to kind of put together because we wanted to make sure we weren't greenwashing and it was super scientific. And we worked with a third party to get the scientific value and credibility to develop it.
I get that for sure. Well, with this being earnings season, I've been talking to entrepreneurs about some of their earnings calls. We just had John Zimmer on, president and co-founder of Lyft, to decode a recent earnings call. I'd love to do the same with you, if you don't mind. What were the major updates on The RealReal's most recent earnings?
Yeah. The earnings, I'd say overall went really well. The second quarter was great. We did everything we said we were going to do in the first and second quarter. So first half of the year, Q2 GMV grew 30%, revenue grew 47%, and then EBITDA improved. It was 18% of revenue versus closer to 31%. Last year at this time. So you're seeing our losses narrow. So overall looking really good. I mean, our focus really is profitability. Launched something called Vision 2025, which showed how we would get there. I'd say where we weren't a COVID story. Some companies were, we weren't. It did set us back. So we went public in 2019, COVID hit in 2020. We had a lot of challenges, I'm not even going to sugarcoat it. It was hard. It was a hard time for us. We had to furlough employees. Our GMV cut in half, if not more. So we kind of had to work our way out of that. And now I'm happy to report we're in a much more predictable space. Our business is much more predictable and a lot of that is behind us. But we still do have some challenges. The great resignation was a little, and labor shortages and things like that. But the good news is we have a very solid plan to get us to profitability. And that's really our short-term focus, our short and medium-term focus. And the team's all rallied behind that. When I think of sustainability, I don't just think about being sustainable in the environmental way, but also sustainable as a company. And making sure that we're making the right trade-offs. And we talk a lot about profitable growth. And that's our vision for the company. And we cut some projects that maybe weren't showing profit or didn't have the same profitable growth signs. We're seeing a lot more leverage in our fixed and variable expenses. And just making the right trade-offs and prioritizing across the board. And I think the good news, even through COVID, is that it just made us a lot stronger as a company. We gained, many more efficiencies because of it. And we're seeing our margin increase now. We're seeing the flywheel effect really happening on the buyers and consignors. We're seeing our back getting better. So it's really about now proving profitability. You're going to continue to see those losses narrow through the end of the year and into next year until we get to break even.
We talked to a lot of newbie investors who listen to the show. So if somebody's like, GMV, what is that?
Right. Sorry, I know we use a lot of acronyms.
Soup.
Yeah. I know. I was watching this TikTok the other day where it could have been any company and it was GMV, ASP, HBR.
Totally.
It could have been any company.
And different industries have their own acronyms. It's a whole thing.
Totally. Yeah, but GMV is gross merchandise value. And that's how we look at the demand and some of the health of our business. And then revenue is another product of that minus cancellations and returns. So that's the real meat of the number. And then EBITDA is like our net loss as a company for the quarter.
Thank you for decoding that to somebody who might be a customer and then, you know, wants to become an investor, because as a public company, anybody can be an investor in that company. You talked a little bit about brick and mortar. I have dropped off stuff in brick and mortar. You started more of the brick and mortar going into the pandemic. How has that fared? And what do you see the future of that being as an e-commerce first company going into brick and mortar?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, brick and mortar has been an accelerator to our growth. It's been a big brand play for us because, like we talked about, people didn't necessarily, there was a stigma, right, to consignment, and people didn't know what kind of condition their item was going to arrive in. You know, what does excellent mean to us? What is good condition? What is fair condition? It was important that we kind of showcase what that means. We got a lot of slack, I would say, for opening stores, because people are like, well, you're online. Why would you spend all this investment in stores? And, you know, why does that make sense? And I even had bets with people in the inside the company, you know, saying that's not going to do more than X amount. Like, that's a waste of time or whatever it was. And we opened our first store in Soho in New York, and it doubled, tripled our expectations. And it brought in a ton of supply. That's why we open them at the end of the day. And these stores break even in about a year, which is, you know, really great for the business as well.
Hold on to your wallets, boys and girls. Money Rehab will be right back. Now for some more Money Rehab.
And in this last round of earnings, we also saw some movement from analysts. For those listeners who don't know, analysts give public companies ratings that are essentially recommendations for investors. I'm curious how analysts' ratings change any of your operational strategy. There was recent Bank of America analyst who downgraded his rating of The RealReal to underperform from buy. How does that affect you, your planning or strategy, if at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm, you know, it's another input for us. We have a lot of inputs, and how I like to think about it is we're talking to hundreds, you know, of investors every year, many analysts, and it's, you know, they're seeing things on a macro level a lot of times. So they have some really interesting insights. And I like to think about it as one input, because there's many different opinions, and you'll have one analyst say something totally different than another one and completely contradict others. And you've got analysts who are more short-term thinking versus long-term thinking. And we kind of have to stay true to what we're doing every day. And I think that's really important. But I would say that these conversations that we have with them are valuable. I find them valuable. But again, I think as long as you can realize, as someone that's operating a company, that it's an input, and at the end of the day, you have to do what's right for the company, your shareholders, and you know, whatever's right for your business, which may be more long-term versus short-term, and your employees who are going to all make this happen every day. So again, it's an input, not the decision maker, but again, really good conversations. I don't know if we've ever changed a strategy completely, but I'd say that there's been tweaks based on conversations we've had where they have been eye-opening and interesting. I do think, you know, and we were talking about this the other day because we just had an earnings call, and I do wish there was more conversation around people and planet. You know, and I think that the environmental, social, governance piece is really important, especially the people side of things. And they make our company run. And it's, you know, anyone that's run a company knows it's all about the people internally, too. And I would say there's not as many questions about that. And we call that ESG, the environmental, social, and governance aspect. And I think that's I do think that's changing, which is the good news. But I know that it's more of a focus in the EU than it is in the US right now.
What do you think the biggest thing investors and analysts misunderstand about the company? Is it ESG or is it beyond that?
I think a lot of investors, a couple of things. Well, the P&L, I'd say is misunderstood. I think there's a lot of naysayers as far as, can we get to profitability? And I know we can. And I think we've had some setbacks, but I know as on a whole, we can get there and feel really good about our plan go forward. And then I'd say that there's a misconception just about retail and brand and the impact that we really are having to the consumer behavior. And, you know, if I told you some of the stories that from early on that we had with investors on, should you invest? And they were like, why would we invest in used clothes? Like, you know, we had one investor like put his shoes on the table and say, I see these shoes. I've been wearing these shoes for the last 7 years. Why would I ever sell them? Why would I get rid of them? When I'm done with them, I'm going to throw them out. And so it's just, it's not intuitive to people.
Wow.
And then we had some really great investors who totally got it. And, you know, some of our early ones were women, I will say. And so it was a bit more intuitive because that's the way they're shopping and buying and they can see this kind of change. So it is really interesting, but I will say that I do think it's changing in a big way.
I want more of those stories over drinks another day. This brings me to my next question that I also asked John Zimmer. If you do a Google News search, you'll see praiseworthy and scathing articles on all public companies. It's just the way it goes, yours included. Does it suck being a public company? Do you wish you didn't have this extra layer of scrutiny that really doesn't exist with private companies?
You know, I don't think it sucks to be a public company. I think it's hard. I think it's challenging. I think it's really fun too. I would say it's rewarding at the end of the day. I would say these articles are noise and internally we know that and we keep our eye on the ball. I'd say that our investors on a whole, I'm more optimistic by all of it. And I actually think it makes us better. And I think, like I said, having these conversations with our investors, our board, you know, our shareholders out there, they all have a piece of the company. They believe in the real. They're excited to see it turn. And, you know, they'll stop us and say, you know, when they find out they're real, it's like, I invested X amount when you first went public and I believe in this company and here's what I like. And it's fun. And that is that is very much rewarding. And they'll also give us feedback and they'll say, you know, I wish you could do X, Y, and Z a little better, or I have this experience and I want to be better. And that again makes us better. And we take all of those really seriously. And it has been a challenging time via all the labor shortages and COVID and all of that. But I'd say, like I said, we've come out stronger. I really do believe that. And we're starting to see it in the data and our NPS score and our numbers. And we're continuing to do that work for our shareholders.
How often do you check your stock price? I know you try to put blinders on, but I'm sure it's hard.
Yeah, you know, I don't check it very often, to be honest with you. I'll say I'll check it about every week. I will check it when it comes up in conversation with our employees and all of that. I have learned over the last couple of years that it there's some things we can do to move the stock price and there's some things we don't do. And the stock price just moves up or down and it's nothing we did or said. And so it really is, you really do learn that it's this volatile and especially ours being in the retail space, the tech space, and right now being unprofitable, it is this thing that goes up and down and we kind of have to, again, just really focus on what we can control, which is, you know, our seller experience, our NPS score, profitability, efficiencies, and all of that.
So that sounds like a lesson too to investors who refresh their whatever Schwab or E-Trade account constantly. Would you tell them, what kind of advice would you tell them to try and put their blinders on and chill? It's hard.
It's hard. I totally get it. I mean, there's a, you know, for a lot of these people, there's a lot riding on it. But for me and the real, we're in this for the long run. And we are, you know, I feel like one of my responsibilities is long-term shareholder value and not short-term. And that's really how I think about, you know, every decision we make and every project we're doing and how we are thinking about new projects and onboarding our employees and talking to our investors. So, and I think, you know, if we stay focused on long-term shareholder value, I think the rest of it will work itself out.
I guess that's the only way you can go down this bumpy road of Wall Street. Well, I am rooting for it in a way I couldn't say when I was on other business networks like CNBC and Bloomberg. But I think the core of the business is good for people's wallets and the environment, and that is a win-win for me.
Thanks, Nicole.
For today's tip, you can take straight to the bank. Get in the habit of asking yourself two very important questions before you buy that new sweater you've had your eye on. Number one, what's the resale cost of this item? And number two, is the brand taking steps toward offsetting their carbon footprint? We can make such a big difference to our wallets and the world if we're more mindful of the environmental impact of the clothing brands we support and more thoughtful about the investment we're making in our wardrobes. Spend money. Money Rehab is a production of iHeartRadio. I'm your host, Nicole Lappin. Our producers are Morgan Lavoie and Mike Coscarelli. Executive producers are Nikki Etor and Will Pearson. Our mascots are Penny and Mimsy. Huge thanks to OG Money Rehab team Michelle Lanz for her development work, Catherine Law for her production and writing magic, and Brandon Dicker for his editing, engineering, and sound design. And as always, thanks to you for finally investing in yourself so that you can get it together and get it all. You spend